This is Rafflebix After Hours.
Ladies and gentlemen, listeners, wonderful denizens of the internet, as always, welcome to Rack Addicts After Hours. We're on episode 61, well into the second half of our podcasting century, perhaps, if I may put some sibilance into your ears. You've got Pete and you've got Ben in your ears today. My name's Ben. Pete is the other lovely, gentle chap with me today. How are you, my manwitch, as our friend James might say? Did I use that last
week?
Yeah,
exactly what you said last week.
It's been in my head all the time.
Really? What's it mean?
James. It's a Futurama reference.
Okay.
Hermes Conrad, he always has a sandwich, which looks like a burger. He's like, my manwich! Whenever it inevitably gets eaten by somebody else.
I mean, okay with Futurama, but I there's nothing particular about it. That I can remember, because it's out the same stable as The Simpsons, isn't it?
Yeah, the Matt Groening...
I've moved on. I'm so firmly in the Rick and Morty camp at the moment.
Yeah, it's something I've been rewatching a lot. I mean, I do like Rick and Morty as well. Weirdly, I never watched The Simpsons. Never got into it.
No, it's I forgot about Family Guy. That came in between. It sort of I've leapfrogged over Family Guy.
Yeah, never really got into it. I kind of like bits, but as a series I didn't find there was much to enjoy about the characters, really.
I thought initially it was quite good, but like a lot of things, when they run to too many series, it started losing, you know, I think they'd sort of done it to death a bit, which I find tends to happen. They sort of run out of, I don't know, material, not so much material. They've said everything they want to say. Although Simpsons still going, though, aren't they, I believe?
Yeah, still going. It's mad.
But I don't know Family Guy's. I have no idea. But there's a hell of a lot of work that goes into these animations.
Oh, yeah.
Mostly it's the script writing up front, isn't it? Because the animation follows. So they do the scripts and they do the audio first, and then they animate to the audio, I believe.
Indeed. Well, we've been derailed by me and my terrible memory repeating myself from last week. But what have you been up to? How have you been?
I'm not too bad. I haven't really been up to a great deal, especially. I mean, there's not a lot we can do. We're still under close house arrest at the moment, although we've been given or shown some light at the end of the tunnel today. Our illustrious leader, Boris, has made an announcement in the House of Commons and subsequently did a press conference talking about the roadmap for the UK out. But so hopefully it all transpires. I'm not going to cast any suspicions. You know, we'll just see what happens. But
I'm just looking forward to Rack Addicts in the Park again.
Yes. Well, I'm looking forward to Rack Addicts in the Pub.
Oh, definitely. And so, those lovely little chinks of the little ice cubes in your soda and lime.
Yeah, all the atmospherics. I mean, we did get a couple of those in last year, just at the tail end before sort of things closed in, and then we went back into lockdown. No, I really want to get to the stage which we always planned, was to have the proper studio sessions. You know, we're all in a perfectly acoustic treated environment all together. No weird internet lagging or strange aberrations.
No de-reverbing or excessive editing for you.
Other than that, the only thing I've been doing is thinking about getting some more flight cases. My supplier of choice, which is Swan Flight Cases, are currently doing a deal sort of 3 for 2. So you
across the whole site?
Yes, any three, you get the cheapest one for free. So obviously you make sure that you try and buy three that are all the same price so that you get a good deal. And the average price for a medium-sized keyboard, I mean a 61-key synth, so to speak, is around £170 to £200.
It's a good chunk, but they are... Proper quality ones, aren't they?
Yeah. So I was debating with myself which ones. I was thinking maybe the Summit could do with being in the flight case, and the OB6. And after that...
Hang on, you've got a Summit?
Yes.
How did I totally forget that you'd actually got one? Anyway.
So, and then the other item, I was thinking maybe Access Virus. I've got an Access Virus CI, which could do with possibly being in the flight case. It's not really sure. It's a difficult one because it's sort of trying to rationalise what synths you'd actually possibly take out and where would you take them to?
Yeah, what would leave with you or what you don't want to get rid of, but you might want to retire temporarily and leave something else in its place?
I don't really know. I mean, and also the thought of, as I did with the Poly Evolver, got it flight case to bring to the ModCaf, because back in the day, the synths I had suffered really badly because I'd either carry them around in their original boxing, the retail boxing, which would
slowly disintegrate
on me until there was nothing left. And then eventually they would bandaged up with bits of foam and so forth. And they would suffer greatly. And nowadays I try and keep all my equipment in absolute mint condition. So if I was sort of to take it out, it would have to be fully flight case. It doesn't go out of the house other than
speaking
that.
Of the Poly Evolver leaving the house to the ModCaf, if you go on the Modular Cafe Aldershot SoundCloud page, there is quite a joyous tune that Pete deployed for us. It's just called Rack Addicts Live Set, I believe. One of my favourites. I think I've pinned it to the top because I just go back to it all the time. Really great
stuff.
Yeah,
I'm planning to record that properly. I mean, the Poly Evolver has got multiple outs for each because, you know, how in my talk that I did for everyone, it's sort of that epiphany that I had that it was actually four mono synths in one unit rather than a poly, a four-voice poly synth. And it's got stereo out for each of those voices or each of those individual synths, if you want to sort of categorize them in that respect.
Yeah. So, that bit you had... you had sort of the droney bit, you had the white noisy percussion-y stuff as well as kind of the lead and some effect bits.
Yeah, I mean, there's all four were going. There was all four parts were in there somewhere. So I was thinking of recording them, all those parts, obviously you could record them simultaneously, but all separately. So they would all have stereo lanes in the door and, you know, making a pristine copy of that particular
track. Yes, please.
So again, something I need to get around to doing, but... Mm. You know, it's not as if I haven't got phenomenal amounts of spare time, like all of us.
Get on it, Pete, because I want it.
Yeah.
Want it in my life.
But that was it, really.
Yeah, well, on the flight case front, I know we've said before that we're fans of Tested and Adam Savage in general, but one of the things that I particularly identify that he's spoken about is his fascination with cases and boxes. Obviously, he makes a lot of his own stuff, but I really appreciate a nice flight case or... Pelican cases I do enjoy as well. There's something about something that fits really nicely and then you put your butterfly catches, twist them round. It's, I'm about that.
Yeah, it's very, I don't know how you would describe it. Is there a German word that describes that sort of...
Oh, I bet there is. And most importantly, if we have any German listeners, or in fact any language that uses a lot of fun compound words, please do get in touch on the Rack Addicts UK Facebook page and do let us know if you've got some good words. We're thinking... I've been trying to express this for so long and I've mentioned it multiple times. There's a tactility... precision engineering, just pleasing objects aesthetically and
feels good in the hands, you know, just the weight substance.
There's a lot of things. I'm 95% sure the German language has got something for us, even if it's not 100% what I'm after. There'll be something there.
Yeah, or hopefully someone might inform us.
Well, from flight cases and long German words, my favourite of which is Naturwissenschaften.
What's that mean?
I think it means just science, as in the like the school subject, science. Wait, no, my other favourite one is Black Forest Gatto, which I believe is Schwarzwalder Kirchtorte.
Okay.
Great fun to say. Anyway, I have been sort of promoted, in a way, at my job at the media company. We do a lot of live streaming. And sort of virtualizing events for companies, a lot of the time that means we need some kind of green room. So we have a virtual green room. We have two computers running vMix, and I used to man the one that all the speakers would call into. And I'd be, your well-spoken host, you know, I would just direct them to the controls on the bottom of their screen and let them know of the facilities we have available and that sort of thing. It's good fun. But not the most challenging of jobs, but I've been promoted to Vision Mixer, which is quite stressful and I'm worried and nervous. But that'll be actually, you know, doing all the stuff for what the audience sees, transitions and putting different speakers on, you know, all the live stuff, which stressful.
Well, it's good. I mean, it's good. It's has sustained.
Something new to learn.
Sorry?
Something new to learn.
Yeah, but it's good that it sustained itself through the through all these lockdowns.
It has done well, thanks to one very big client, which is quite handy. I think it's pretty much kept the whole company going while we're sort of few and far between on the more normal projects that we have.
Well, I suppose that you've been able to sort of lend yourself to the new remote viewing conferencing sort of new normal.
We've been working on, you know, that showreel, say, you need virtualized solutions for all the things that you used to do. Here we go. That kind of thing. Like, we did a company's end of year wrap up type of thing, and they sort of dispatched green screens and camera systems to all of their people, and we all stitched it together in the end. That was quite interesting.
And as I say, I don't think it's going to end anytime soon, even if eventually when the pandemic fades or lessens. Yeah. I think these trends are going to persist. Certainly the working from home.
Even when we're totally back to how we were, there are certain advantages to all this remote stuff.
Well, I believe a lot of firms are actually disposing or looking to dispose of their offices if they can. They're sort of looking at, they've got buildings that are coming to the end of their lease. They're thinking, well, we've operated perfectly well for the last year almost in some respects. Yeah, why do we need to continue with this? So let's just dispense of that building and cut our costs, increase our margins.
Of course. As an employee, might not work if you're unfortunately, like me, stuck with the worst internet in the country.
Yeah. Well, as we said, it's when you do your next move, that'll be the most important question you've got to ask before.
Absolutely, and I can't wait to have workable internet.
You were saying August?
Around about August, so it's not a massive amount of time.
So how soon before that will you start planning to...
It depends on whether we attempt to get a mortgage or not, which that's going to be a kettle of fish to unravel and not especially normal, given we don't know how house shopping would work at the current time.
The market's been very buoyant, but there's been these forecasts of crashes which don't seem to have happened.
Yeah.
I mean, it should be feasible. I mean, our ex-colleague purchased one just before he left to go to Universal Audio.
Indeed. Yep, that one's all sorted, and I think he's actually getting a lot happier in his flat at the moment. He wasn't too happy with it, but been speaking with him, and he's enjoying the new job a lot more, which is quite cool.
Luke purchased a property not more than 2 years ago, I believe, relatively recently.
Indeed.
Anyway, so it is feasible in this sort of it's something that can be achieved when you sort of you've got two incomes. Unfortunately, seems to be the case.
Assuming we get approved, I'd be quite excited to pay less in monthly rent or whatever.
So that would be the plan then, necessary not to rent anymore, because you're mostly paying more in rent than you would do on a mortgage.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So it'd be a discount in the monthly outgoings, and we can get cats finally.
Yeah.
So that'll be the way forwards.
How's that going to go with your allergies?
I don't know.
Are you worse with cats or dogs?
Yeah, it's just furry creatures in general.
But
dogs do it.
You can acclimatise to them, can't you?
I think that must be how I was fine previously. I'm not sure I necessarily believe in acupressure, but my dad got an acupressure treatment series of. How long ago would that have been? Nearly 30 years ago, and he's not allergic to cats anymore. So I was going to give that a go if it doesn't always work.
But I always thought that a lot of the allergy, when they sort of look at treatment, including things like nut allergies and things like that, which obviously can be quite dramatic with sort of anaphylactic shock and so forth, that they look at exposing the sufferer with small amounts and increase the dosage and try and sort of acclimatise them to that particular thing that irritates them or sets them off.
Yeah, when things start to open up as well, that will be a little bit more easy, because I can go back to my parents' house where my cat is.
Oh, you possess one, or your parents possess one?
His fat family cat. And yeah, when I left for uni, after coming back after about a year, I discovered
I see. I
need antihistamines and inhalers and things.
How does it affect you? I mean, does it extreme? Do you have sort of eyes puffing up and throat
it's
closing?
It's not that bad. I get a bit itchy.
Yeah.
Start wheezing, because I'm asthmatic anyway, so it sets that off. It's not too bad.
Okay.
It's just kind of annoying.
So, I mean, are you going to get priority on the inoculation being asthmatic?
I doubt I would jump over any of the age categories. I think I might be ahead of the queue for my age range. That's about it. By no means severe asthma anyway.
Quite a few of my friends have been inoculated already, and they're all in the same similar demographic, but some of them are a lot younger than they were scheduled to be. I mean, not a lot younger, but they were below the threshold for the schedules and so forth. Yeah. But it does depend what health authority you are and so forth. But I don't know about yourself. Personally, I'm looking forward to getting my injection, at least get the first one. Just to get that feeling that, well, certainly after a few weeks once it's taken, get that feeling that I might have a potentially have a bit more protection against it.
Yeah, and it'll feel like a bit of progress, which we haven't had for a whole year, have we?
No. Been such a strange scenario because people have sort of fits of exasperation with it. And, you know, I'll have, you know, I've had good and bad weeks. You know, most of the time I'm pottering along and suddenly it just sort of gets to you and you think, how long is this going to go on for? I've heard the same thing from other people. I mean, the main people I actually speak to these days are just our colleagues when we go into the store. But you hear them, they're going all, sort of along, they're perfectly fine, and then just something gets to them, and they just, you know, just they don't sort of throw their toys out their pram and get all upset. Everyone's just so exhausted with it.
Definitely.
No one I know really personally has suffered really badly or been very ill or lost anyone. All the stories I've heard have all been sort of slightly removed or remote, luckily so far. So fingers crossed, you know, I just want to get to the finishing line without sort of falling at the last hurdle, so to speak.
Definitely. Whenever the finish line might be,
yeah.
I'm quite excited for the modular cafe to resume as well. If I may direct us in the synthy direction.
Yeah.
Another thing I've been doing this week since the announcement of a certain mutable instruments module, which we'll get into in a bit, I've made a quick spreadsheet of modular cases because the brewing is brewing. I do want to dive back into modular again. I made a spreadsheet which is just a list of cases that are in my price range and just figuring out the cost per HP. So I will deliver you my findings.
Okay, far away.
So I'll be realistically under £350, though I do have the IntelliGel 7U Performer case on there. What do you think is the worst or the least economical case that I've put on here? So the under 350-ish kind of bracket.
What, when you say economical, it doesn't come with a power supply, too small for
these I should have said, these are all powered cases.
Okay. And when you say least economical, do you mean you get the least HP for your money?
Exactly. Most expensive per HP that you get. I think the...
It's got to be
lowest we've got is
surely it's one of the IntelliGel ones, possibly.
£1.10 will be the most economical we've got.
So, have you done a calculation per HP then?
Exactly.
Oh, that's a novel way of doing it. I suppose that's a logical way of doing it. Off the top of my head, I would possibly IntelliGel then because they're not cheap.
It is an IntelliGel. It's not even the 7U, it's one of the pallets.
Okay.
62 HP. That's going to be £4.46
per HP.
Yeah, it's not good.
No. What was the...
So the cheapest...
Yeah.
Yeah, so that is the Behringer.
Yeah, what a surprise.
The Eurorack Go, as it is called, and I've kind of written that off because I don't trust it, though I haven't met one yet. So the next one would be the Dopfer low-cost 12U.
Okay.
And then it's either that or the two-row, which I think... most appealing to me. The Arturia 6U does come in quite strong, about £1.70. We've also got an 84 HP 6U case from Audiophile Circuits League at £1.76. The 104 HP 6U is £1.66. So those are tempting as well.
So as we have said many times on the show, you can't go wrong with a Dopfer inexpensive case.
Exactly.
So the 12U is the sort of optimal one, and the power supplies are really good on them.
Yeah, totally. One that does stack up quite high, though you do need some kind of 19-inch rack, is the Tip Top Happy Ending kits are £1.30 per HP. And that includes actually a pretty decent power supply too. But yeah, Dopfer, just the standard, the dependable.
Oh, I had considered one of the Dopfer 12U, but the flight case ones, but they're not cheap, are they? They pay quite
No, they end up being about £100 more expensive, I think, in the 12U category.
But good for portability, having a lid.
Definitely. And, yeah, reliability and all that kind of stuff. In fact, Bob Ayrland, who toured with the BBC Radiophonic Workshop, he has one of those, and the little strip up the top where I think sort of dope for logos and stuff are. He took that out and replaced it with acrylic and put things like buffered multiples and a few switches and stuff in there. So,
optimizes it even more, just extra.
Exactly.
It's a shame it doesn't take the what's that format that goes horizontally?
The other one, is it Pulp Logic?
Well, I mean, IntelliGel do them as well, don't they? Do the strips, but I don't know if they're the same size.
Yeah, the one U stuff. I think they might be dimensionally the same, but require different power. I can't remember. I haven't really looked into 1U, to be honest. But yeah, that was a fun little calculation.
But have you made a decision? Waiting. That's the core thing.
Yeah, I think it will be the dope for three row one. Then when I eventually outgrow that, the base one.
Yeah, just a little angle. You get the traditional sort of L shape thing on the go.
Exactly. And then to maximize my YouTube and Instagram hashtag aesthetic, I'll probably put it in the garden room among all my plants. Be a nice place to be.
When do you expect to make the purchase?
Next month, month after, potentially.
Not rushing
that
in then?
Kind of area. Not especially.
No. And you've got all the prospective modules scoped out, have you?
Yeah, in fact, let me open up my modular grid and I tend to keep them arranged in which order I might go, but I'll let you know what's on the radar. Since the only modular thing I currently have is the Subharmonicon, it would want to be something that plays nicely with that. So it could be an effect, most likely an effect. But I would quite like to have something DIY to chew on, just because I just really enjoy the DIY and I do miss it. Potentially one of the Music Thing modular spring reverbs, because those are fun. A bit of an effect for the Subharmonicon.
Okay.
But more realistically, I'm thinking the FX Aid from Happy Nerding.
Okay.
Really nice little multi-effects in 4U. Then there's sort of utilities like just get a nice output module. After that, I think it's going to be the Juicy modules. So Beads is on there, which we'll come back to in a sec. And then it'd be that sampling something. So Morphogene maybe, Qubit Pulsar maybe, something in that variety. We'll see. See what's on there. Instro, Arbor, or Lubad, one of those. But I will let you know when a decision is made. But let's jump into Beads, I reckon.
Okay.
Since that's our new release. At last, the sequel to Clouds is here. Though I would have thought, since they went... what was it before Plaits? Yeah, Braids and then Plaits, as in the kind of hairstyles. I would have assumed that Clouds would then be mist or some other sort of weather related word. So I don't really know where beads came from.
I don't know, beads of rain or
potentially. I suppose it could have been drops. Either way, it's refined. It has clouds like things in there, but it's slightly, I suppose, tightened up, a bit more predictable, a bit more playable in that sense. But already I know three members of the Modular Cafe have either received or pre-ordered them. I think the sort of was it Rubber Double Cymru Beats, one of those UK based shops, sold out of their stock in about 6 hours, which is pretty
No one's currently got any in stock at the moment. I've checked.
Doesn't surprise me at all. I think the next batch most retailers are reporting is kind of end of April or something, so a little bit to wait for everybody else who missed out.
Well, how do Mutable do their manufacturing? Do they do it in-house or do they sub it out? Or
as far as I'm aware, it's all the boards are all going to be populated and the modules completely assembled in China, but they all go through quality control at the hands of Emily, as far as I know.
So that's the bottleneck.
That's how it was last time I checked.
That's where it slows down. But that's a good policy. But you think
definitely,
be...
and it's part of the thing. Yes, yeah, she just wants to really make sure it's up to her standards. So
certainly, yeah. But you'd think they'd be able to produce a lot more if they're having them made in China and they know what the demand is. But I suppose maybe that's part of the attraction, isn't it? Sort of drip feed them out, keep people interested.
Yeah, I imagine if it is all quality control by one, potentially two people.
Could take quite some time to...
Yeah, it could be why there's such a gap between modules sometimes, because you've got to psych yourself up for endless QC.
Well, we've got to remember they're not just supplying the UK, they're supplying Europe and the US and Japan as well.
Whole world, of course. Yeah, so, I mean, it's still got the kind of the four quality settings So you have your 48 kilohertz 16-bit stereo will be your kind of maximum quality, which gets you about 4 seconds of recording time in the buffer for further granularization. That one, and then you can go down to 24 kilohertz with cassette emulation in mono, and that gets you up to 32 seconds of freezable audio. You've got a few different grain generation modes, different parameters to play with. It's the usual thing, you know, granular. It's going to be playful, usable. I think one of the ideas for this was to try and remove some of the kind of press and hold to access different modes, a little bit like what happened when you went from braids to plats. There was less in terms of hidden menus and all that kind of stuff. There's just focus on making it nice and playable. Hopefully more predictable than the old clouds as well, because it can be a little bit odd sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, it's still a place for it. I don't see myself ever getting rid of my clouds.
No, well, they're different enough to, like we were talking about with the Metropolis and the Metropolix, it's still worth having both if you can.
Yeah, if you can afford it.
Different
certainly.
Vibes.
And you've got the space.
Yeah, speaking of, actually, we've got a price on the Metropolix. Was it $509, Pete?
Yeah, well, that was at Rubber Dub in Glasgow. It's slightly more expensive to other retailers, but $509, but again, pre-order, so I'm not sure how long that would be.
Mm.
But I was off because I was sort of saying around $650, so I was... Yeah. I was pleasantly surprised at that price. That was considering the predecessor was going at around 550 prior to its demise. Mm.
Yeah, we will see what happens with the used market on that one. But it's been discontinued now, hasn't it?
Yes, it has.
Yeah, as I mentioned before, that DIY version by the original designer still available. That's, I think, the direction that I'd go. And definitely would like to go. Maybe that should be my first module. Hmm.
What about the Turing machine? Are you going to build? Because they're a nice build.
Oh, yeah. It is a really fun build, and it's definitely on the list. Though, having sort of been there, done that, it's not not a priority, but I definitely need to have one of those again.
Well, I'll try and get it. What's his name? The gentleman that does the Euclidean circles. I'll give him another prod
yes.
to see if he's...
Absolutely. If you do get kits out of him, just sign me up and I'll pay you back, because that's
yeah,
definitely what I want.
He was
going
to contact me when he had some, but you know how these things go. Other than that, it would just be the only other place I've seen the kits available is in the States.
Mm.
And I don't really want to. I suppose it's just as difficult to get stuff from Europe now, so it doesn't really make a hell of a lot of difference. It's just that.
Yeah, because I mean, when you first asked, we were still part of the European Union.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe it'd just be a straightforward, you just send it to me in the post, but now it's all going to be very difficult.
Yes, indeed. Well, let's quickly take a detour out of the modular world. Still very much synthing. One thing that I'd quickly like to chuck in, this is just kind of a teaser sound demo. There is a French synthesizer company that's not massively well known called Balloran or something. I've probably butchered the pronunciation, but they had a really big, full-on, majestic polysynth called The River, which is reasonably famous, also definitely very expensive. But they've just teased a new hybrid module-looking dude with a big old screen on there and lots of control. It's called The Pool. And there's a video with some noises. Seems pretty cool, and it's a very big, flat module. I've no idea if this is going to be final design or what might change. But, you know, it's lots of modulation, lots of filters, lots of options, this kind of thing. But it's going to be a big old polysynth like the other one.
Okay.
So, from mysterious releases that may turn up at some point... to one that is, you know, kind of on the doorstep, and we have now managed to get our greasy mitts on the Behringer Mono Poly. Pete, you're a famous hater of the Poly D. Mono Poly is in the same chassis-ish.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts on prodding it?
Well, I only sort of contemplated the aesthetics and had a sort of a feel of the knobs, so to speak. You were the one that was testing it, so I didn't really get to hear exactly how it sounded, although you were just using headphones. That's not always the best way to hear these things anyway,
and bad headphones at that.
So aesthetically, It does look a little bit better than the Poly D in that respect, and I do acknowledge it is the same chassis. Well, it seems to be relatively the same chassis. But I was pleased to note there was nothing digital I could see, which is always a bit of a curse.
Yeah,
it's
just those mode switches with the LEDs and nothing else, buttons. It's
I don't recall. Does it have memories on it?
No.
So I'm trying.
I don't know about the original.
I think it's this one, although it's got the usual slight design differences, which they're obliged to put in there to keep away from offending anyone's patents or copyright. Or as soon as you've designed something, it instantly has a copyright, isn't it? Because it's got a design aesthetic. So, you know, litigation could follow. So, but they've kept quite close. It's got the blue, hasn't it? That look to it. Mm-hmm. What did you think about the sound?
The text looks very similar. It sounds nice. I'm not overly familiar with the original. I did enjoy the way you kind of access the modulation and the way you've got really easily accessible range controls for both the pitch and the kind of the mod wheel. And one thing that was notably really irritating about the Poly D is the way that it kind of handled the whole paraphonic experience. I can't remember what they called them. They're sort of, I think it's uni and then poly, and then there's one other mode, and it's kind of trying to be a hybrid of, you know, you press one note and it works kind of legato, but you can still do your chords. And it was a bit of a nightmare, and we got a lot of complaints about it. And I think they might have changed how it works, but no, jumping through all the different modes, and if you want, you know, one oscillator just playing lead stuff, unison, or having the paraphonic stuff, it all just seemed to work, which was refreshing. And surprising.
Well, that would be good. I mean, it would be interesting to see how they do in the field, so to speak, because I, as you were aware, I was dealing with another slew of broken Poly Ds or customers that had problems with Poly Ds.
Yep.
I mean, I've never known anything to be so problematic, even from Behringer. And I don't know what's gone wrong with that particular that particular product.
No, I think you're right. It's just the digital stuff. Whatever they did for sort of the inverted commas voice allocation, I think that's sort of where it's all going kind of wrong. But yeah, lifting that sequencery stuff, that's not gone well.
Well, it's also what did I have? I had the customer, the problems with the key bed, because the key beds aren't great on there. I mean, you know, they've had to cut costs. That's where they've saved money. I mean, they've obviously, all these things are built to a budget. And but the one was the gentleman had that his chorus buttons weren't working anymore. They weren't engaging anymore.
And worryingly. Oh, wait, no, actually, I take that back. They're not the same, are they? The chorus ones on the Poly D, they're kind of the big chunky.
Yeah, the big square ones.
Latching ones.
Yes.
And it's more of just like a momentary clicky.
And they weren't latching.
Thing on the Poly D. Okay, we're all right on that front then.
Yeah,
I'm trying to think what else they've put those buttons on. Oh, yeah, the vocoder. I think that's where they are.
Another problem which comes up regularly is people complaining about tuning problems with the Poly D.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, modern synth should have tuning problems. Not with modern electronics.
I seem to remember one quite protracted tuning issue with a customer. We did manage to get like the calibration procedure out of Behringer, which involves opening it up and twiddling with some trims on the...
Yeah, that doesn't sound right at all. You shouldn't have to be doing that.
Not ideal. No.
I mean, you do see... what products? I'm sure I've had products. It's the Moog stuff. I mean, it was the Mother 32. It came with a little calibration tool, doesn't it? That you've...
Yeah, because cleverly, there's just a hole in the faceplate where you poke a nice, long, thin screwdriver to do it, and that's kind of fine, because it's easy to...
oscillator, so you've got...
Yeah, only one thing to worry about.
And I'm sort of used to calibrating. I mean, some of the oscillator modules that I've built as kits, I mean, I've, you know, worked with the calibration. It can be a bit tricky. I mean, how was I doing it? I can't remember if I was calibrating it with a scope or with a voltmeter. And then in fact, it was so long ago. It was one of the DynSync ones that was having a bit of thing. And you also, I think you had to calibrate the filter as well, obviously, because they can self-oscillate and so
use
forth.
Them as oscillators. Yeah. I think my only calibration frustration, that's going to be the name of an EP anyway, was the Bifaco Even VCO, because I had the one before they'd pre-soldered some surface mount stuff that did temperature compensation, so it was only good for maybe 2 octaves. It had a really good range, but it was just kind of unusable.
When outside those 2 octaves, it just was all over the place.
Yeah, you know, pick your root note and tune that up nicely, and then octave up, you're fine. The next one got a bit wobbly. Yeah. You know that one gig where you did some video for me?
Yeah.
I was cursed with an out-of-tune bass line on that one because of that oscillator.
Yeah, I think it's possibly one of the sort of generic types of kit to avoid is oscillator kits. Cause,
Yeah.
If it's some sort
unless you have precision calibration equipment on your own, like a really good scope and all that kind of stuff.
Suppose you get a Jones O'Toole, you can look at the waveform. But I don't know how much use it is apart from being pretty. I don't know if you can actually use it in any sensible diagnostic way.
Not sure. I mean, there's the other one that's really popular. It's in all the DivKid videos.
Yes, that's the Mordax.
Nice one. Yeah, Mordax Data. That's the one. That seems a bit more hi-fi and precise to me, but I don't know if it is.
Well, that's just so much more than just an oscilloscope. That's almost everything because it can do so many roles.
Yeah, because it can sort of generate its own modulation sources and things like that.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's got infinite functions, but it's got a hell of a lot it can do. But they're not cheap.
Perfect
either
for his kind of video.
I kind of contemplated getting one way back in the day, but no, never. I prefer. I mean, I know that we've sort of, over the years, that modular's got a lot more dense functionality, sort of shrunk down. But I do like a kind of very simple module that, you know what it does. Some of the old traditional stuff.
Now, that's part of the consideration for me when I'm sort of heading back in is the menus and alternative modes, they were just kind of frustrating, really. So the deepest I'd ever want to go would be the Euclidean circles one, because the manual can be printed on one piece of paper that just shows there's a few options that you can set. Like the way I had mine set up was there are six channels in total in two pages, which are really easy to flick between. I had the button set as a start stop, just easy, have that there. And then I had the bottom channel set as kind of a 16 step gate sequencer on both channels. And then the other four would be the Euclidean ones, and it was great.
Excellent.
I miss that module. So pretty.
Well, anyway, you can always get another one.
Oh, yes, I can. And this time I should build it with my own hands. We got sidetracked. We were talking about the mono poly, which will probably be fine, and we'll see what happens, but hopefully we'll have less of them back once they're actually out.
Hopefully
in the world.
None of them back.
Yeah, better not. A quick one to mention as we kind of fly past, there is some sad news for fans of some classic electronic music. Daft Punk have parted ways. Apparently there is no reason available to the public. There is a sort of farewell video called Epilogue up on YouTube at the moment. They are no more at the moment. 28 years later, isn't it?
You wonder what the rationale about that was. Why announce it in that such a way? Unless you sort of...
Irreconcilable differences.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the one. I don't know, maybe. I was going to say, they didn't seem the type of people who would, arguing with each other, but
well,
it's not like you really know.
I've never seen their faces.
No, who knows? Maybe they just want to move on to other things. And with such a huge group and really famous back catalogue like that hanging over your head, you wouldn't want to
sully it.
Just ignore it. Imagine you want to announce something just so you could properly.
Maybe one of them's retiring or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, they're not spring chickens.
No. How? What kind of age? I don't really know. How old they are.
No, well, that was all part of the mystique, and they've kept that kind of mystery thing, which is mostly worked
reasonably successfully. I mean, you can easily find out who they are, but in terms of if you accidentally happen upon them on the internet, they're just their masks.
Yeah.
So let's move over to another small nugget that we've got here. The Orba by Artifon, makers of the Instrument One. These things turned up in our store, in our stockroom. We just kind of walked past them and just don't really know what they are.
Actually, I think I saw one a couple of weeks ago, and it was only... I didn't pay any attention at all.
Yeah.
And then they had they did them on Sonic State last week. And I think I'm just a bit nonplussed, a bit ambivalent about them, to be honest.
I've seen a few videos of them. It's like... They just seem really gimmicky to me. The Instrument One being an MPE device and, you know, a different way of approaching things did seem a bit more useful, I guess. This one just has the ring of kind of toy about it, the same way that Roly Blocks do.
Yeah, that was another one that didn't really inspire me in any shape or form, but they were quite popular for a time, the Blocks, weren't they?
Yeah,
I seem to remember when people were forever asking for them.
Always asking for a demo, which they, no, no, yeah. Can't demo them, no.
It really difficult to demo. Yeah. And then suddenly it all stopped. So I don't know if they're still available, but suddenly the demand just fell away.
Yeah, I think Roly themselves were having issues with their finances, to be honest, because their C boards definitely weren't selling well and they were very expensive. And then they had to kickstart or GoFundMe or whatever Lumi, the illuminated keyboard, yep, which is kind of cool and still very expensive. But yeah, I don't know that they're doing especially well.
So what's the thing about the Lumi? I mean, I'm unaware of what
so
it is.
It's quite a nice form factor and it's very nicely designed, but just small Bluetoothable MIDI controller. I believe it has some MPE functionality as well, but the main thing is that the keys light up. So it's primarily designed as a learning tool. And it was quite well used by Andrew Huang in a video about the Supertonic and why pop music is using it all the time. And as the keys light up as you press them, it's a really good visual aid for that kind of thing. But I think, like I said, primarily designed as a learning tool, that functionality.
Oh, okay. Well, I was aware that it lit up, but I couldn't think of a reason why it would want to do that or why you'd want it to do that.
I guess you could do the same thing as the Native Instruments S-Series controllers do, where they have those LEDs at the front and you can light up the different sections of the keyboard, especially in a full orchestral patch to show where your instruments are. That's quite fun.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, they're just little gimmicky things for the bedroom producers. I think that's really what they're all about.
Well, people looking for a present, you know, they launch these things, you know, around Christmas time. They mostly go quite well. Looks pretty.
Yep, they're small and definitely stocking sized. They're not stocking priced. Those ones, 100 quid, I believe, aren't they?
Yeah, £99.
That gets us through all the synthy bits, I believe. Anything else to chuck in there, Pete?
Nothing especially I can think of. It's still lean times, as I say. Not a lot was announced. You know, we haven't really had any trade shows. Not sure if there's what the situation will be with trade shows for the rest of this year.
Mm-hmm. We shall see. We shall see. There's definitely been some exciting news this week in the spatial world. That's definitely not the best way to refer to the cosmos, but Luke's definitely got some exciting stuff to talk about in Luke's Spacey Bit.
Hello there, space fans, and welcome to Mars. If you've been living under a rock, then you might have missed that not one, not two, but three Intrepid spacecraft successfully made it to the Red Planet over the last 2 weeks, completing their long journey through the void, which started in July last year. The Emirates Mars Mission orbiter named Hope successfully entered orbit around Mars on the 9th of February and returned the first images that it will capture of the planet. The first image sent back shows Mars against a black background with the day-night terminator cutting neatly across the planet at a diagonal angle. We can see its white polar caps and a range of several mountains referred to as shield volcanoes due to their weird shape. Olympus Mons is also visible. This is the tallest volcano in the solar system, dwarfing Mount Everest by 2.5 times at 21 kilometers or 72,000 feet. Hope is now in an elliptical orbit high above Mars, which will decrease in size as the craft uses the gravity of Mars to slow its velocity, eventually reducing the highest point of the orbit, or apoapsis, to approximately 43,000 kilometers above the surface. Once this is done, the craft will set about its mission of investigating the Martian atmosphere, as we covered on the show previously. On the same day that Hope sent home its first postcard, China's Tianwen-1 entered the Martian sphere of influence after performing its final braking burn. The craft successfully performed its orbital insertion and is now swinging around the red planet. If all continues to go well for Tianwen-1, it will release its rover package to land on the surface of Mars and begin the search for water or previous signs of the elusive substance. The rover will use ground-penetrating radar, amongst other tools, to search beneath the sandy surface. Which reminds me of Kim Stanley Robinson's Red Mars, a 1992 novel in which the first colonists of Mars tap into enormous, sometimes frozen aquifers hidden deep beneath the surface rock and sand of the desolate red planet. In the book, these aquifers allow the colonists to terraform and survive on the surface of Mars using a source of water that may not be there in real life. The CNSA have released a video showing Tianwen-1's orbital insertion. This is available online and shows that the bright morning side of the planet seeming to move unnaturally past the craft as its frame of reference shifts to Martian orbit. It is worth noting that this video was taken with a maintenance camera and is not indicative of the quality of the main instruments on the craft, which will be similar to the image that the EMM Hope sent back previously. Happily, the NASA JPL Perseverance rover has also arrived safe and sound at Mars, touching down in Jezero Crater on the 18th of February. Shortly before I recorded this segment, NASA released footage of the EDL, that is the entry, descent, and landing suite of cameras and microphones, showing from multiple angles the intense moment that the rover touched down. Unfortunately, the microphone from the EDL suite did not function as intended and didn't actually capture any audio from the descent. However, there is another microphone installed on the system, which is part of the rover's actual science package, and this has sent back some audio clips of Martian weather and the sound of Perseverance shortly after it landed. You can listen to these audio recordings, they were part of the NASA livestream. To some, they might not sound like much, it is after all just wind being captured by a microphone, but take a moment to understand what these recordings actually signify. It is the sound of wind moving across another world, somewhere no human has been. It's a staggering thing to actually comprehend when you listen to these sounds, that they are of an alien nature. And we are, of course, very lucky to be living in a time where we can record the sound of another world, so it's a very nice bit of icing on top of the cake to have that sent back along with the video from the EDL suite. The video itself, I encourage you to watch, it's nothing short of amazing. We start with the parachute deploying at the end of the atmospheric entry phase, slowing the craft down to subsonic speeds in preparation to cast off the heat shield, which protects the rover and descent stage. I think my favourite thing about this section of the video is that it looks like a normal day on Earth. Images from Mars are often colour corrected to compensate for signal loss or false colour created by the camera itself. But despite knowing this, the sky seems grey blue and the sun shining down on the top of the rover really grounds this video in reality for me, which is helpful because the next stage is absolutely out of this world. Our view flips around to show us the down facing camera and we can see the heat shield drop away at 12 kilometres from the surface. The dialogue here confirms radar lock on a landing site. One of the most interesting things about Perseverance is that this landing process is entirely automated and governed by the onboard computer. Next, the shell and parachute is detached and the rover enters power descent mode. The video then splits to show us a sky crane dropping the rover down onto the surface of Mars from three different angles, which is just fantastic. We see the invisible hydrazine thrusters kicking up tremendous amounts of dirt before the sky crane disconnects from the rover and flies off to ditch in the dust and sand far away from the rover landing site to avoid damaging it. So there we have it. Perseverance has landed on Mars, and the other missions are in orbit around the red planet. Perseverance is the first stage in a sample return mission which will require the ESA to aid in the delivery and collection of samples back to Earth over the next few years. Among other experiments, NASA JPL operators now in control of the craft will test the Ingenuity helicopter, which we've spoken about before, and perhaps most excitingly, an experiment called MOXIE, which stands for the Mars Oxygen In-Situ Resource Utilization Experiment. I'm glad that one has an acronym. This unit aims to test the viability of producing oxygen from the carbon dioxide-rich atmosphere by splitting the carbon dioxide molecules into carbon monoxide and oxygen. If this is successful, it will pave the way for large-scale systems of a similar nature to be brought along on future human missions, which will greatly increase their safety and viability. Going back briefly to that idea of an alien landscape seeming somewhat familiar, the first images from the rover's mast cam have been sent back. The quality of these will increase with the deployment of the high-gain antenna, allowing the cameras to operate at their full resolution. But for now, raw images are available on NASA's website, including some gorgeous panoramas showing the mountains surrounding Jezero Crater Delta. It's absolutely stunning. You can see the hazy mountain tops of Mars in the distance, and it really does look like a sort of strange desert landscape. It, you know, it very well could be somewhere here on Earth. It's amazing to see how similar the two planets look, and it just really helps ground the mission in reality for me. I encourage you to check out those images. The panorama is viewable on the Wikipedia page for the Mars 2020 mission, but also, as I said, other raw images are coming through and being uploaded to the NASA website as they come. That's it from me today. I hope you've enjoyed the segment and that we've encouraged you to check out these incredible images and videos yourself. Our warm congratulations go out to all of the scientists and engineers involved in these projects. If you have anything regarding these news items to add or any other synthy business, then please get in touch via the usual modern methods. Tune in next week for more space news, but for now, it's back to my co-hosts. Stay safe. Bye-bye.
And round to the end of the podcast once more with our miscellaneous multimedia recommendation. And this time I didn't forget what it was called and I didn't stumble over the delivery of the emphasis of the M's. So here we are. Pete, mine's ready to go. Would you want to go first?
It's totally up to you. How do you feel?
I'll steam ahead. A channel, one person, a harp player, a harpist, I don't know what you call a harp player, called Emily Hopkins, nice and easy to spell this time, and she's got a load of cool videos where she's just using pedals, guitar pedals with a really nice harp, and it's just the best. So really cool pedals like your stuff from Chase Bliss, your Earthquaker devices, so the slightly left field and weird ones, which are pretty great. My personal favourites would be the Afterneath, and the one that I've been listening to most is the Hologram Electronics Microcosm, and it's just so cool. Most of the stuff typically goes in the ambient direction quite fast, which I'm not going to complain about at all. But it's really cool seeing some more classical instruments, or just instruments you wouldn't expect, being used with modern music technology, guitar pedals, and especially the weird ones. But yeah, really cool stuff. Emily Hopkins. And if you see a harp and you see a guitar pedal, then you've landed in the right place. That's where I would go. What have you got for us, Pete?
Well, I've got a bit of a cracker this week. I don't know if you saw this whilst checking things out. Basically, as usual, YouTube channel is GeForce Software, people who originally started out doing sample packs for Akai samplers. I believe I had a few GeForce, and then subsequently making soft synths, emulations of classic synths.
There's a great video on the Oberheim 8 voice on their channel.
Yes, there is. Yes, exactly. One. So as you've obviously seen the channel and seen that they have done quite a few videos on individual classic synths and so forth. But this week, or last week, I should say, they released a documentary. And I think, I'm not sure, but I got the gist the documentary might have been done 2014, 2015. I'm not really sure, but they only released it on their YouTube channel, as I say, last week. The documentary is called Bright Sparks. It's in two parts, and you get the first one's called A-Side, and then the second one's called B-Side, so it's got a sort of vinyl connotations. So basically, it features eight of the pioneers of synthesis. Video is about an hour long, or just over an hour. And the first one focuses on mainly US pioneers. So it goes through Bob Moog, Don Buchler, Alan R. Perlman, and Harry Chaplin.
Who's Harry Chaplin? That's one I haven't come across.
Let's have a look. You'll have to watch the...
there we go.
But it's quite an insight. It goes into quite a lot of depth with all of these, a lot deeper than I've seen. So it has Bob Moog's daughter talking about the synth, people that work with him at the outset. So they go as deep as they can with the people who are still alive at the time when the documentary was filmed. And it is interesting. It's a super deep dive into the psyche of, you know, what they were thinking when they had the ideas, what their motivations were, and so forth. Generally, they've gone for people who actually worked within the companies or worked with these people. And there's also some interviews with the people in question as well.
Hmm.
So, and nice then the second, the B-side, focuses more on UK synth manufacturers. So the...
Got some EDP action in there?
Yep, it's got that. It's got the gentleman behind Wasp. I don't know which ones are which. But let me have a look. The Brits, and I'm not going to try and pronounce the gentleman from EMS. Is it Peter Zinoviev? You can pronounce it when someone tells you how it's pronounced. But try.
Not that I've ever heard it pronounced. So you could be pronouncing
Zinoviev
it just as wrong as I'm
doing. Absolutely spot on. But when I try and read, that's my dyslexia showing. When I try and read it, Ken Freeman, was it Electric Dream Plant? Are they something to do with Wasp?
I do not know.
I think they are. I think that's the actual.
Oh, company. EDP. Yeah, of course. That is Wasp.
Yeah. So Electric Dream Plant or EDP.
It's like Motu, when you suddenly discover that that stands for Mark of the Unicorn. It's all these little weird,
yeah, exactly,
weird acronyms.
And then Harry Chamberlain, I said before, he's ARP. I think he's... No. Alan R. Perlman is ALP, or ARP.
Yep.
There's an interview with him. He goes on about some interesting phone calls he initially had from Bob Moog, who was sort of saying, I hope you're not copying my equipment and so forth. But yeah, it gives you that, you know, it just gives you a sort of an insight into it that I've never had personally before. So it's a really good watch. If anyone that's at all interested in synthesizers would love it. Both those, and they've got some shorter behind the scenes little 5-minute videos about the making of the documentary or the conception of behind it. But it's a really good watch.
Definitely some stuff to get our teeth into. Well, I hope everybody, especially our esteemed regular listener David, has enjoyed this incredibly synth-heavy episode. Thank you, as always, for listening to Rack Addicts After Hours, and do tune in next time. Farewell.